Let's take your Bibles, if you would, please. Go to Psalm 128
as we continue in our Psalms of Ascents. Psalms of Ascents, they're used more than once. They're repeated as the people of Israel go back time and again to Jerusalem, three times in any given year. And not with empty hands, God said. He wants them to bring a sacrifice that reminds them of His grace to them each time they come. Psalm 128, six verses. He begins in verse 1, "Blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in His ways. You shall eat the fruit of the labor of your hands, you shall be blessed, and all shall be well with you. Your wife will be like a fruitful vine within your house, your children will be like olive shoots around your table. Behold, thus shall the man be blessed who fears the Lord. The Lord bless you from Zion. May you see the prosperity of Jerusalem all the days of your life. May you see your children's children. Peace be upon Israel." We want to be impressed today with the weightiness of God's glory, God's worthiness. We're going to start with something rather mundane. We're going to start with license plates, okay? We're going to get there, okay? We'll get to weighty and glory. We're just going to start with license plates because we're all familiar with the nickname of our home state, right? So Pennsylvania is the Keystone State. I'm from Minnesota. What's the nickname of Minnesota? The land of what? The land of cheese. That's Wisconsin. Cheeseheads are Wisconsin. Minnesota is the land of 10,000 mosquitoes. Lakes. Let's try another one. How about Florida? What's that one called? Sunshine State. California? The Golden State. Oh no, the Golden State. I'm sorry. The Golden State. Did you know that Nevada is called the Silver State? I didn't know that. Some titles and labels have come and gone over the years. Iowa, for many years, was known as the Corn State. Kansas was known as the Wheat State. Nebraska, what do you think that one was? The Beef State. Where's the beef? Nebraska. Needless to say, that didn't last real long. Okay. So some come and go, but there's some that aren't leaving anytime soon, just because the reality stays the same. Delaware is always going to be the first state, right? Alaska will always be the last frontier, just because of where it sits geographically. There's not too many people that know the ins and outs of Alaska. Arizona will always be known the Grand Canyon State, because it's kind of hard to relocate the Grand Canyon. Okay, so some things are just there. One of the states, it's no longer on their license plates, but they can't get rid of the stigma that's gone with it, is Missouri. What's Missouri called? The Show Me State, right? The Show Me State is Missouri. And so this is something, as we think about this, we tend to kind of laugh at the sentiment. This sentiment of show me does tend to resonate in all of us, doesn't it? Prove it, at least in part. There's something in all of us that wants something to be proved. Don't we all kind of have this show-me spirit? It's kind of interesting that the Bible doesn't necessarily condemn this stance. In fact, at times, the Bible actually seems to encourage a show-me, prove-it kind of invitation. Psalm 34:8. "Oh, taste and see that the Lord is what? Good." I want to prove it to you. God says, take me up on this. Show me. I want to show you. Taste and see I am good. John 20, after Jesus is resurrected from the dead, Thomas, who got the name Doubting Thomas, is right? He says, "I'll never believe unless I can put my fingers in those hands and thrust my fist in his side." When Jesus shows up, what does he say? "Thomas, let me show you. Put your finger here and see my hands. Put out your hand and put it in my side. Thomas, don't disbelieve, but believe. Let me show you. Let me show you. Hebrews 13, verse 7. Remember your leaders, those who spoke to you the word of God. Consider the outcome of their way of life, then imitate their faith. I've shown you in the people that have given their lives to my word that it's worth it. Look at it and follow it. So this invitation of show me is in fact woven into the very scripture themselves. The psalm that we looked at this morning, Psalm 86, David is audacious enough to pray for it. He starts that last verse with the same words. God, show me. Psalm 86, verse 17. Show me a sign of your favor. Show me a token of your goodness. Show me. But listen for how he finishes it. He says, I'm not just praying this for myself. I'm praying this for others. Show me a sign of your favor so that those who hate me may see and be put to shame because it's you, the living God, Yahweh, who's helped me and comforted me. This is the spirit of the psalm that we come to this morning, Psalm 128, especially verse 4. He says, behold, look, I want to show you. In this manner shall the man be blessed, the one who fears the Lord, the man who fears the Lord. Let me show you. I want you to see what this looks like. So this week's passage builds on last week's passage, Psalm 127, and it builds on some of the same themes, and even the very proposition that we saw last week. We saw in Psalm 127 that the greatest work of God's people is depending on God while forging relationships in the service of others. And that's still true. As we come to Psalm 128, this is the greatest work that God has called us to do. And unless the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. And he's going to use this household terminology. He's going to use sons and children as he did in Psalm 127 to help us see what the blessing of God looks like for the people of God. But he's going to move it just a little bit forward. And he's going to tell us this morning that God's blessing consists in knowing his life in the process of showing his life to others. Is that how you would define blessing? God's blessing consists in knowing the very life of God. And where do you experience that life of God? It's as you show God's life to others. So your life becomes a conduit of the very life of God. That's what Paul says in Galatians chapter 2, verse 20, as we're looking at the book of Galatians in our Wednesday night Bible study. Paul says, I'm crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live. Yet not I, but Christ lives in me. And the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. But he says, it's no longer I who live, but it's Christ who lives in me. And now, Galatians, let me tell you, you are chasing after death. So look at my life and God's life in me so that you might receive the very life of God as well. Follow me as I follow Christ, essentially, is what Paul says in the book of Galatians. God's blessing consists in knowing his life, in the process of showing his life to others. But this text, as it's written, prompts us to ask three questions about this blessing. What does it mean to be blessed? What does he mean, be blessed? Verse 4. Behold, thus shall the man be blessed who fears the Lord. For each of these questions, I want us to look at a guiding text. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 28. Because what we're going to see is that when he's speaking of blessing, he's speaking in the context of covenant. He's speaking to the covenant people of God, and he's speaking about the covenant blessings of God. Deuteronomy chapter 28, beginning in verse 1. Moses is telling the children of Israel as they go into the promised land, listen, if you faithfully obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments that I command you today. The Lord your God will set you high above all the nations on earth, and all these blessings, plural, shall come upon you. All these blessings shall overtake you if you obey the voice of the Lord your God. You can run, but you can't hide from God's blessing is the idea there. Verse 3, blessed shall you be in the city, blessed shall you be in the field, blessed shall be the fruit of your womb, the fruit of your ground, the fruit of your cattle, the increase of your herds, the young of your flock. Blessed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed shall you be when you go out. There's not a realm, there's not an arena in the mundane life of the ordinary Jew that wouldn't be touched and filled and chased down by God's blessing. Surely his goodness and mercy would chase them down all the days of their lives, is the promise of Deuteronomy chapter 8. So it's important to understand that the picture that's given here is one of covenantal blessing. But it's also important for us to understand that covenant blessings come from a God who has the desire to bless. Don't ever separate that. We say, oh, these aren't for us because we're not part of that covenant. But wait a minute. Jesus said, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, given for the remission of sins, right? You have a covenant. God has made a covenant with you. Why? Because he's a blessing kind of God. That's the whole point. The covenant defines and delineates the realm of blessing. Why is that important? Because we forfeited it at the fall. God told us in Genesis 1, listen, you'll be blessed, be fruitful, be multiply, and be sovereign over this world. Guard it, keep it, protect it, till it, develop it. You're blessed. What does Adam do? He watches as his wife listens to a serpent who tells her that she can be like God. She says, hey, that's a great idea. Oh, why don't you become a God with me? And he says, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. Boom. Things go so far south that their very first child kills their second-born son. I mean, you talk about failure as a parent. Can you imagine the guilt that Adam and Eve would feel at that moment? God had told them, in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. And yet they outlive their youngest son, who dies at the hands of his brother. Now what? And for six chapters, we see that this sin grows and it becomes universal and it takes over as man continues to grab after God's goodness. And then in chapter 6, we see that God says, so much violence, so much taking, so much grabbing, I'm going to destroy the whole lot. And so he wipes them out. And in Genesis chapter 9, we have almost the exact same words as God speaks to a second Adam, if you will, a new man at the head of all creation, and says, Noah, I bless you. Be fruitful and multiply. And by chapter 11, the whole world comes together and says, no, we're not going out into the world. We're not multiplying. We're staying here. We're building a name to heaven, and we're going to make a name for ourselves. We will be like God. Boom. So chapter 12, God, relentless in his desire to bless, says, Abraham, I'm going to choose you. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make you a great nation. I'm going to make your name great. And I will bless all families on earth through you. So yes, these are covenantal blessings that are delineated for us in Psalm 128. But I want you to understand that covenant blessings come from a God whose desire is to bless. That doesn't change between Israel and the church. That doesn't change between old covenant and new covenant. These are for us as much as for them. So keep these things in mind as we read through this together. Because blessing is what God does, because blessing is who God is. It's built into his very nature. What is blessing? Blessing is receiving goodness from another. Very simply, blessing is simply receiving goodness from another. Well, where does all goodness have to come from? All goodness has to come from the only one who is good, right? And guess what? God in his goodness is an ever outflowing dispenser of goodness. He's a trinity, a triunity. The Father is ever spilling out his goodness to the Son. The Son is ever spilling out his goodness to the Father. The Spirit is ever spilling out the goodness of God in relation between Father and Son. And you have this outward flow of the goodness of God before there was ever creation. And when he creates, what happens? And it was good, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good, and it was very good. We have this goodness-dispensing God who in his very nature is outward flowing in his goodness. Psalm 119 reminds us in verse 68, you are good and do good. That's our God. He is a good-dispensing God, and to be on the recipient side of that blessing is to receive that goodness, and to receive that goodness is to be defined as blessing. So he uses a couple different words here for blessing. We see in verse 1, blessed is everyone who fears the Lord. Verse 2, you shall be blessed and all will be well with you. Those two words are the word asher or ashrei. And they can be translated as happy. Happy as in wholeness. Spurgeon said, the blessed man is happy because he's the child of the happy God. We oftentimes don't think about God being happy, but when God speaks in, well, let's take Hebrews 1. He quotes an Old Testament passage, but in Hebrews 1, he says, I will anoint you, my son, with the oil of gladness above your fellows because you are holy. When we think of holy, we think of somber, sober, anything but happy. And God says the absolute opposite is true. To be holy is to be happy. To be unholy means to be exempt from happiness. You say, oh, Pastor, you have no idea. I am most happy when I am most unholy. You have no idea. Because you wake up the next morning and there's regret. You wake up or you walk away from that conversation where you're stuck up to a good, right? And you are happy to do it. And you're left with that pit in your stomach and said, I wish I hadn't have said that. I wish I hadn't have done that. There's regret, there's shame, there's pain. To be holy is to be happy, and to be happy is to be holy. So the word blessed there has the idea of happiness. In verse 4, to be blessed is the idea of God doing the blessing, of God dispensing the blessing. So the one is a state of being, to be whole and therefore to be happy. The other has the idea of the process of God doing the blessing. The same thing in verse 5, the Lord bless you. The Lord do in the process of giving you his goodness from Zion. Everson said this, the word to be blessed is the opposite of to be cursed. It describes the good things that God gives to his people. So being blessed in this way produces a happiness or a blessedness of state, to be in that condition of joy. You've received God's goodness and now you bask in it, you taste it, you're savoring it. It's like when you put that, my girls are, I think Kaylee is working on custard, refining her custard capabilities. And she has to try another batch. I never am disappointed when she has to try another batch, right? So you take another spoonful of custard, you put it in your mouth, and what do? You don't take the whole blessed thing and swipe it all off the spoon, right? I don't know why we do this. We take it out, and then we look at the spoon and see how much we left on the spoon. And then you kind of taste it. Oh, yeah, that is good, right? Okay, you taste it. You savor it. That's the idea of this blessedness, of happiness. You've entered into a state of joy. And guess what? There's still more on the spoon. You didn't eat it all. God has more joy to spill out into your life. Leopold says this, the initial word here, which we've translated happy, indicates a kind of superlative. Blessed is everyone who fears the Lord. It's the same exact start as we have in Psalm 1. It's how the whole Psalms, book of Psalms, starts out. But it's written as a plural. Because apparently this word never occurs in the singular. There's no such thing as a single blessing. It's literally translated, oh, the blessings. And Spurgeon says, the idea is heaped up happinesses. They'll be happy in a thousand different ways. Happiness upon happiness upon happiness belongs to the one who fears the Lord. So what does it mean to be blessed? It means to enter into the joy of God's goodness. It also means to be full or perhaps successful. Peterson says this, blessing has inherent in it the power to increase. In fact, the characteristic of blessing is to multiply. And so as we watch down in verse 3, we see that children are like olive shoots. His wife is like a fruitful vine. This blessing of God isn't just a once and done kind of deal. You spent your dime at the gumball machine and that's all you get. This is taking the seed, planting it, experiencing its growth, tasting its fruit, and going back for more. There's this continual growth and power of increase in this blessing. I like how Peterson observes this. He says, the way of faith itself is in tune with what God has done and in tune with what God is doing. The life of faith has the support of an entire creation and the resources of a magnificent redemption. The structure of this world itself was created by God so that we can live in it easily and happily as His children. Oftentimes, unbelievers think, you know what? I could never be a Christian. That's way too hard. But what does the Bible say? The way of the sinner is hard. The world thinks about this backwards. Peterson writes, it's not believers who have it hard. It's the unbelievers who have it hard. Religion is an inconvenience only to those who are traveling against the grain of creation. If you go against the grain of the universe, you get splinters. I like that. If you go against the grain of the universe, you get splinters because the way of the transgressor is hard. It's the way of the holy that's easy. It's the way of the holy that are happy. That's what it means to be blessed. I'm not working against the grain of creation. I'm working with the grain of creation and redemption. This blessing has the idea of being content with what we have. And having food and raiment, let us therewith be content, right? Okay. But Calvin says, we need to develop a better and deeper concept of what happiness is. Better and deeper than those held by the world, which makes a happy life to consist in ease and honors and great wealth. What does the Declaration of Independence say? We have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How do most people define the pursuit of happiness? Ease, honors, and great wealth, right? Calvin says, listen, we've got to get beyond that. We've got to get beyond this idea that God's blessing resides in ease. In just a minute, we're going to look at the fact that God's blessing is primarily found in labor. rather than ease. Alter, who's not necessarily a Christian, but he is a Hebrew linguist, he says this: it should be observed that the good life is not imagined in terms of wealth, but in sufficiency. Verse 2, a man shall eat and enjoy the fruit of his own labor. He's not stockpiling. He's not accessing the stockpile of somebody else. All he's doing is enjoying that for which he labored. It's that daily bread. That's what blessing looks like. So let me ask you this morning, are you blessed? Where does your mind go when you're asked that question? Am I blessed? Do you say, well, I don't have, and I don't have, and I don't have, and I, so I'm not blessed? Or do you say, you know what I have? I have a full belly. Anybody here not have a full belly? I think we have some more matzah or crackers or juice downstairs. You can see Sarah about that. We have a full belly. We've slept on a bed last night. Unless your wife kicked you out and you had to sleep on the couch. But you slept on a bed last night. You had a home with a roof over your head. You probably enjoyed air conditioning. You were able to drive a car to get here. These are just mundane things. But God says, if life is working for you, guess what? I'm working for you, and you are blessed. You woke up today and you walked in on your own two feet. You are blessed. You have a child sitting with you next to you in the pew. You are blessed. You have clothes that don't smell, that don't stink, that aren't wrinkled. You are blessed. You are blessed. And we need to redefine how we define blessing. Much of the world's happiness depends on taking. But the Christian enters into blessing as he learns that it is more blessed to what? Give than to receive. Why? Why is that? Well, if you're a parent, what do you like more? Your birthday or your child's birthday? If you're married, which do you like more? Your birthday or your spouse's birthday? Why? Well, it's always fun on your birthday to get, right? But it's always fun on somebody else's birthday to give. And you're looking for, you're like a kid. We got married. I didn't realize that my wife had this childish infatuation with going under the tree and shaking the presents. I said, what are you doing? You can't do that. But she just loved shaking and rattling and finding out what's in there, because her mom did it. Right? I said, you can't do that. But we all have that childish pleasure, right? Of, we know what it is to be excited about getting. But as we grow, it's been fun to watch my kids as they learn how to, and my wife, as they learn the joy of giving. As you watch them, as they're watching somebody else open up the present that they purchased, that they've spent time and invested and made phone calls and texts in order to collaborate on getting just the right gift for that sibling, and then you watch them, they've got more joy than the person who opens it, and they're filled with joy. That's what it is to enter into this blessing, this life of God, this life of giving. He's going to use a couple other words. What does it mean to be blessed? It means to be happy, it means to be full, it means to be content, it means to be satiated. It means to know how to let go and give to others because you know that God has given you enough. It also means goodness. Verse 2, you shall be blessed and it shall be good to you. It shall be well with you. It's the Hebrew word tov. It's the same word that's used down in verse 5. The Lord bless you from Zion. May you see the good of Jerusalem. Goodness. What is goodness? It's a favorite question Dr. Larry Arn, the president of Hillsdale College, asks freshmen. What is the good? The good is that which fulfills the purpose for which it was made. That's very close to the New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and exegesis. It says, the good is a state of function appropriate to genre, purpose, or situation. It's that which fulfills the purpose for which it was made. And by extension, that is good which causes a thing to succeed in the purpose for which it was made. It lets it be all that it was created to be. So it's translated in verse 2 as a well-being verb. It shall be well with you. You will be all that you were created to be. You shall experience all that you were created to experience. You shall know the fullness of that for which you were made. Well, I guess I'm not blessed, right? I feel like I was made for something more. That's what it means to be a pilgrim. That's what it means to be a child who's en route to being with your Father. You were created for something more. But you're recreated, and you are being filled up with the very Spirit of God, and you're being prepared and prepped and changed and tweaked and slowly disciplined into the holiness that will belong to you in its fullness in the presence of God. Okay. That's the goodness that God is pouring out on you. It's rightly translated prosperity in verse 5 because that's exactly what God's goodness does. It prospers us. It enables us to know the fullness of God's goodness. There's one other word that this whole psalm wraps up with, and it's the word peace, shalom. When we're talking about blessing, we can't disconnect it from happiness, we can't disconnect it from God's goodness, and we can't disconnect it from shalom. And shalom is the idea of more than just an absence of tension. It's the presence of everything that enables that thing to thrive. Not just survive, but to thrive, to be all that it was meant to be. And so when I experience God's blessing, I'm filled up with God's goodness. I know God's peace in such a way that it spills out into the life of others. And that ever-flowing goodness of God spills out of me so that God's goodness flows into another person's life. That's the idea of shalom, that there's this harmony. Not because there's an absence of tension, but because the goodness of God fills each digit in such a way that it lubricates that close proximity. And it ministers so that there's more than the sum of the parts happening when you bring these people together. That's what a family is, right? A family is more than the sum of the parts. You get them together, and all of a sudden, you've got energies that were never there. That's why when you take one of the family away, it's like, we can add another person, but we don't have the dynamic, right? So it's more than the sum of the parts. That's what shalom is. So what does it mean to be blessed? It means to be happy. It means to be full. It means to be successful. It means to be filled up and spilling over into others' lives. One writer concludes this: everyone wants to be happy. I don't think they're wrong. Everyone wants to be happy, but too many people are willfully refusing to pay attention to the one who desires our happiness most. So we have to ask a second question. What does this blessing look like? Well, thank you for asking. Verses 2 and 3 are going to help us understand what it looks like. But again, there's going to be a guiding text. So it looks like blessing in the field, blessing in the womb, blessing in the basket. Let's go to Psalm 73. Psalm 73. What does God's blessing look like? Asaph is in a quandary. I mean, his t-shirt's in a knot as he's trying to put this together and says, how does this work? Verse 3, I was envious of the arrogant. I saw the prosperity of the wicked. The word prosperity there is the word shalom. Filled up and overflowing. This doesn't make sense. They have no pangs until death. Their bodies are fat and sleek. They're not in troubles like others are. They're not stricken like the rest of mankind. Pride is their necklace. Violence covers them like a robe, a garment. Their eyes swell through their fatness. They've got such chubby cheeks that they can hardly keep their eyes open. Their hearts overflow with their follies. They scoff and speak with malice. Verse 9, they set their mouths against the heavens. Their tongue struts through the earth. Verse 11, they say, how can God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are the wicked. They're always at ease, and they increase in riches. Okay. What does it look like to be blessed? Asaph says, I sure think I know, and I sure think I'm not one of them. Well, let's take a look. Verse 2. To be blessed, you shall eat the fruit of the labor of your hands. We're basically going to have two sections in this. In verses 2 and 3, we're going to be tasting God's goodness. In verses 5 and 6, we're going to be seeing or beholding God's goodness. Tasting and seeing God's goodness. He wants us to taste it. Verse 3, you shall eat, you shall taste. It will be well, it will be good. You'll taste this. You'll be successful in your labors. You're going to eat the fruit of the labor of your hands. Not eating the labor, eating the fruit of those labors. You've worked hard for what you've gotten. Enjoy it. That's where Ecclesiastes says, you know what? Here's the greatest thing that you can do in this life under the sun. Work hard and enjoy it. That's a good thing. You've entered into this. It's a blessing. It's interesting that Psalm 1 begins with the blessing on, blessed is the man who does not walk, right? Here the blessing is on the man who walks in God's ways. There's this activity. There's this movement that's required. Spurgeon says, to enjoy the divine blessing, we must be active. We must be walking. God is the God of laborers. We're not to leave our worldly calling because he's called us by grace. We're not promised a blessing upon romantic idleness or unreasonable dreaming. We're called to inherit this blessing by hard work and honest industry. He says, I want you to learn to eat the fruit of your labors, and it will be good. It will be satisfying. You ever got done just before company shows up? You've cleaned the bathroom, all right? It's not this monumental task. Anybody can clean a bathroom. You train your child to clean a bathroom. But you get done cleaning the bathroom, and what do? You turn around and you look at it. You've not seen your bathroom before, right? But when you get done cleaning that bathroom, you turn around and you look at it and you go, it's good. And you breathe the sigh of relief, and you enjoy it for just a moment before the company shows up. You see this clean bathroom. That's enjoying the fruit of your labors. You watch a kid march across the stage. They receive the diploma, and what do you say? If anybody knew what it took to get that kid there at this point, right? You're enjoying the fruit of your labors. That's the idea. There's hard work that goes into it, but it's so satisfying because God's been so faithful through that entire process. It's tasting God's goodness it's in successful labors. It's also in significant relationships. He says in verse 3, it will be well with you. In what way? Well, your wife will be like a fruitful vine within your house. This is interesting. He's going to talk about the wife of the blessed man, and he's going to talk about the children of the blessed man. And remember, as he starts out, this is kind of a generic blessing on anyone who fears the Lord, but he brings it down in verse 2 to you. You can access this. You can taste this. You should experience this. This is your wife, your kids. Where is God's blessing experienced? It's experienced in relationships. Relationships that are significant. Why are they significant? Because they're the closest relationships that you have in life. What makes them significant? It makes them significant that they're fruitful and that they're growing. Look at these two illustrations that he gives. He says, your wife will be like a fruitful vine. So we have this vine imagery where the wife is going to be the fruitful vine, and the idea is a grapevine, clusters, life, clusters of grapes, which you mash and you store and you get wine and refreshment and bring it out for joy and for celebration. And he says, your wife will be like a fruitful vine, rich, productive, spilling over into the lives of others. And the context will be within your house, or the King James has in this at the sides of your house. But the idea is in the recesses, in the hidden parts, the corners. Not that the wife is not a productive member of society. You keep her veiled and shut up in a dark room in the back recesses of your house. That's not what it's saying. The idea is that of the wife inside the house draws attention to that this is the normal sphere of where the mother operates. And it's the most productive sphere in which she operates. It's not that she doesn't see a field and buy it, Proverbs 31. It's not that she's not making girdles for the merchants, Proverbs 31. But she's meeting the needs of her household. She's primarily making an impact on the people in her home. And so what does the American dream tell us? If you really want to be a woman who's going to make an impact in life, where do you have to do it? Outside the house. The biblical economy does not ban women from working outside the house, but it says her most productive role is inside the house, shaping another generation, shaping the lives, shaping the imagination, shaping the heart, shaping the values of raising another generation, bringing people into her house. Sometimes we're not able to have children. What do you do with that? So that person's not blessed. So that person doesn't have the primary role within the house. No. The idea here is relationships. And what makes the house the home? It's not the dad. The dad is out in the field. The dad's fixing the tractor. The dad's catching the bull. The dad's outside the house. Dads don't necessarily make the house the home. You know that if you've ever been in a boy's dorm. Okay. We used to do this weird thing at Pillsbury Bible College, and we'd have an open house at Christmas time, and you'd get to go in and see the boy's dorm. It was the one time in the year when they cleaned it. That was it. Then you go in the girls' dorm, and what do you have? You have lights, tool. I didn't even know there was tools other than fit in toolbox. But this like see-through kind of tool that glows when you have these Christmas lights. Like they did that. They got something more. They have the same rooms that we got. It's the same brick walls. But it looks like you entered into a home. Why? That's what a mom does. And he says, this is her productive role, where she fits. She turns your house into a home, and she's like a fruitful vine. Everything she touches, she breathes life into. Why is that the case? Go back to verse 1. Blessed is everyone who fears the Lord. His wife is productive. Why? Because he fears the Lord. The whole idea here is that these relationships are fruitful. They're growing. They're significant because this man is breathing life into the life of his wife. And what does she do? She breathes life into the life of their home. That's the point. Verse 4, or verse 3.5. Your children will be like olive shoots. Oh, what's that look like? Well, what's the great spiritual blessing I'm supposed to get from that? Shane, you're an olive shoot. Woohoo! Right? Well, sprouting, right? Growing out of clothes. Well, that's kind of the idea. The olive shoot is the idea of those little suckers that come off the bottom of the roots. And they're growing up. And they're just as hardy as the tree itself. You cut them off and they sprout right back up again. And the idea is, all these little treelets are clustered all around the trunk. And that's the picture that he's giving to us. They're hardy. They're fast-growing. Alex Spurgeon says, the woman is busy all about the house, but the children are most active at mealtime. Right? So we have the picture of the table. Your children will be like olive shoots around your table. That's where their arena of activity is. They're eating. They're consumers. And praise God, there's enough to eat. Because God's blessing, because of the man's labor, and because of the wife's productivity. Okay? All of these things are working together as we experience the blessing and the life of God. I like what Hamilton says. The integrity and godliness that accompanies the fear of Yahweh will nourish and enliven the whole field of family relations. The wife in the home will feel loved, safe, secure, and flourish. Spurgeon says, joy from the fruitful wife, the solid comfort of the growing family, these are the choicest products on earth, and our families are gardens of the Lord. He makes our relationships happy and profitable. So where do we look when we look for leaders in the church? Paul tells Timothy, I want you to look at men who are able to manage their own households well. Are the people that they do life with flourishing? Because if they're not, you must consider what their influence will be like on you. So he says, look at their home. But if he's talking about more than just the home, and we'll see that he is in just a moment, he's going to be talking about these homes that are fearing God, that are productive and fruitful and growing, sided up by another productive, fruitful, growing family, another fruitful household, another fruitful, you have a whole city. And soon you have a whole nation that's experiencing this blessing of God. So let me ask you, how are your relationships growing because of you? Well, what relationships are you talking about? Well, let's talk family relationships. Husband, how is your wife doing? Yeah, well, she really struggles with, okay, how is your walk with God affecting her struggle with XYZ? Wife, how's your husband doing? He always, okay, how does his struggle with XYZ, how is that affected by your walk with the Lord? How is your church growing because of you? Have you built into a community? How is your friendships doing because of you? How is the workplace doing because of you? Where are you breathing life into the relationships that God has given you? Are you breathing life into relationships, or are you sucking the life out of relationships? Well, that's a huge difference, right? What's the difference? The difference is accessing God's life, knowing God's life, as I distribute God's life to others. If you're not intaking God's life, you can't distribute God's life. If you're not receiving God's blessing, you can't dispense God's blessing. You can't give what you don't have. Now look at the relationships around you. What do those say your life does have or doesn't have of the life of God? That's the question that we have to ask ourselves. But it's not just manifested inside the house. It's possible for us to have this mentality, right? Family is everything. Everything else is just everything else. We can make our families a little God, if you will. God is the one who gives the blessing. God is the one who gives the happiness in the home. It's dependent on Him, not my wife, not my kids, not even me. It's God who gives this blessing. But He looks beyond the family, and He looks at where this family fits in the larger picture. Verse 3. The Lord bless you from Zion. May you see the prosperity of Jerusalem all the days of your life. Zion is that place of the temple. It's at the top of the hill there in Jerusalem, and it's where God's people go to worship. It's the temple where sin is dealt with, where God's blessing goes forth. And this blessing is dispensed to every single household within the covenant community. He says, do you understand that as you live out your life of faith in God inside the walls of your house, it affects your neighbor? It affects your employer. It affects your cousin. It affects the person down the street. It affects the police station. It affects the fire department. It affects everything within your community. God's blessing on you brings blessing to others. It's not hard for us to understand. God's blessing on others brings blessing to you. That's what it is to be in this context, arena of blessing. He says, you will see God's goodness all the days of your life. And all the days of your life. He's saying, there will be much life for you to enjoy, much happiness. That's what he's saying. That's where this is going. Where? In what arena? In your house. In the city. In fact, he closes verse 6. In Israel. In the whole country. In the whole blessed realm of God's kingdom, may you know the blessing and the happiness of God's blessing. So we've asked ourselves, what does it mean to be blessed? What does it look like to be blessed? Looks like those relationships that are fruitful and growing. So how do I access this blessing? We're going to go to one more guiding text, Numbers chapter 6, verses 22 or 24 through 26. God tells Aaron, the priest, and the priests are going to be at that tabernacle, eventually the temple of God, where the presence of God is administered. The blessing of God goes out. He says, I want you to bless the people this way. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you that overflowing goodness that spills into other people's lives. Peace. Shalom. And we have a picture. The priest ministering in the presence of God and ministering inside the tabernacle or the temple of God, bringing the showbread, every bread representing a different tribe, a different house, a different part of the community. Where is it set? It's set exactly opposite the candelabra, made of 75 pounds of pure gold, shining with seven different lamps straight across the room on every one of those pieces of bread. The light of God blessing and illuminating every single tribe stacked within that showbread. And he says, I want the priest to pronounce the blessing of God that it might go out upon all of the people. That's the blessing. It comes from God. It's dependent on God. It's dependent on a right relationship with God. That priest only ever enters the sanctuary by two means. By sacrifice and by washings, by cleansings. First he takes care of sin. Then he takes care of dirt, right? He makes sure that he's holy, he's ready. That's why you have the altar and the laver right outside that tent or that tabernacle. And so he goes in and he secures that right relationship between God and man on behalf of all the people. So how do I access this blessing if it's totally dependent on God and it's totally dependent on a right relationship with God? How do I access this? Let's go back to verse 4. Behold, thus shall the man be blessed who fears the Lord. Verse 1, blessed is everyone who fears the Lord. Accessing this blessing requires first a specific attitude, fear. The fear of God. We think of fear as a bad thing, but it's not always. A writer from the past, Robert Nisbet, writing in 1863, says this, this is the fear that a child feels toward an honored parent. It's a fear of offending him. It is that which fills the breast of a pardoned and grateful rebel in the presence of a venerated sovereign at whose throne he's permitted to stand in honor. A fear lest he should ever forget his goodness and give him cause to regret. It's a fear of offending the one who gives you blessing. It's a fear of wasting that love that he's lavishly poured out on you. It's a fear of bringing a frown to his face when you long to bring a smile. It's a fear of disappointing. It's a fear of not living up to. Not a cringing kind of fear, but a longing kind of fear to bring him pleasure, to enjoy that relationship. We tend to think of God in ways that bring God down to fit our categories of convenience, where we can please him by simply our best efforts. That's not true. We need Jesus. The fear of the Lord is the idea of receiving God for who he is, of rejoicing in his goodness, of being mystified by his majesty, of being filled with awe at the wondrous works that he does, of being overwhelmed by his holiness, and that he would count me as holy because of the work of Jesus. It's being enamored once again with God as God. It's finding his splendor as something you want to gaze upon. I think it was interesting. Spurgeon says, no, but it was Peterson. Eugene Peterson said, you know, the Bible isn't really all that concerned that we believe in God. It kind of generally assumes that we do. What the Bible is primarily concerned about is how we respond to God. Do you take God and chisel him down, whittle him down so that you can understand him? You're only going to believe a God that you can understand. Or are you letting God be the God that he is, a God that you might not ever understand, but you trust? A God you might never understand, but you love, and you know that he loves you. Will you let God be God in your life? If you do, he will bless you. Yeah, but what about Asaph? He's looking around. He didn't feel blessed. Let's look at Jesus. Jesus, the Holy Son of God, the one who's crowned with glory, the one who is anointed with the oil of gladness above his fellows, right? Let's look at Jesus. Remember the last psalm? He gives to his beloved sleep. Where do we find Jesus sleeping in the Gospels? In a boat? At what time of day? Night? In the middle of a storm? That's blessing, right? We find Jesus crying out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Yet before he breathes his last, or as he breathes his last, what does he say? Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. That's peace. That's blessing. That's joy. It killed him. Remember what Job said? Though he slay me, yet I will trust in him. That's peace. That's blessing. That's goodness. Yeah, we need to define it different. But if God can give you peace in the midst of a storm, if God can give you joy even in crushing you, my friend, that's something that the world knows nothing of. And that kind of access to the life of God will breathe life into those around you. Maybe you're not breathing life because you're not willing to access life. You want those flowery beds of ease, and you get mad when you don't get them, and you take it out on those who are closest to you. Blessed is everyone who fears the Lord. It looks like walking in his ways. I read a lot of different articles throughout the week. Some of them are true, some of them aren't. But I read of a father who received a letter from his son. I loved how it summed it up. He said, Dad, if I had to sum up the common theme I've seen in your life, I believe it would be the fear of the Lord. Thank you for modeling the fear of the Lord for me. Thank you for raising me in that same fear, and thank you for reaching back and saying, follow me as I follow Christ. It's been encouraging, Dad, to see the promise of Psalm 128 fulfilled in and through your life as you've been faithful. I truly thank God that you're my dad. Folks, that's a rich man. What do people in your life say about your life? Do you have the very life of God pouring in your life so that the life of God is spilling over into the lives of others? God's blessing consists in knowing his life in the process of showing his life to others.